Shango, Erumale, Shango, Majuba, Eile, Iwaloba, Kuso. Amabu Shango, yeye.
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 Amabu Shango,
that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For Auntie, the oldest there are. She rocks all us children to sleep in her shawl. D is for Daniel, who tends to the door. He took care of Massa way back for the war. F is for Felix, who won't do no work. He's lazy and shiftless and ready to shirk. Z is for Zonia, chunky and small. But here come the missus, so I guess it's them all.
Mammy, there ain't no way to wash clothes. What you all need is rhythm.
What do you all mean, rhythm?
I'll show you what I mean.
The mammy, the pickaninny, the coon, the Sambo, the Uncle. Well into the middle of the 20th century, these were some of the most popular depictions of black Americans.
Rumbly up there!
Rumbly up there. She rumbling, rumbling, knuckles brought him down to the nub, yeah.
By 1941, when this cartoon was made, images like these permeated American culture. These were the images that decorated our homes, that served and amused and made us laugh. Taken for granted, they worked their way into the mainstream of American life. Of ethnic caricatures in America, these have been the most enduring. Today, there's little doubt that these images shape the most gut-level feelings about race.
When you see hundreds of them in all parts of the country persisting over a very long period of time, they have to have meaning. They obviously appeal to people. They appeal to the creator, but they appeal also to the consumers, those who read look at the cartoons or read the novels or buy the artifacts.
It's not just that it's in the figurines and in the, you know, the coffee pots and so on. It is that we are seen that way, perceived that way, even in terms of public policy. And that our lives are lived under that shadow. And sometimes we then even become to believe it ourselves.
Blacks don't really look like that. So why is it so appealing to people to think they look like that, and to pretend they look like that, and to like to look at icons that look like that? You look at them often enough, the black people begin to look like that, even though they don't. So that they've had a great impact on our society. They therefore tell us both about the inner desires of the people who create and consume them, and also they tell us about some of the forces that shape reality for large portions of our population.
Well now, children, tonight old Uncle Tom is going to tell you the real true story about Uncle Tom's cabin. Now,
contained in these cultural images is the history of our national conscience, a conscience striving to reconcile the paradox of racism in a nation founded on human equality, a conscience coping with this profound contradiction through caricature. What were the consequences of these caricatures? How did they mold and mirror the reality of racial tensions in America for more than 100 years?
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good afternoon to all of you. My name is William Rogers, and I am your host here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here on Tuesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. We have a very dynamic and interesting conversation today with a gentleman that I'm sure that all of you are going to enjoy. We really appreciate you joining us. We hope that wherever you are and whatever part of the world you're in, that you've had a wonderful and blessed day. Very hot day here in Georgia. Temperature was well up into the 90s. And so we were blessed in some ways to have all of the sunshine, but then it was hot too. But nevertheless, we won't complain. We definitely feel that our program today will refresh you and help you to enjoy something. We're going to be talking about some of the history of early racism, some of the format, some of the subtleness of how it was used. And we have a young man that's going to be with us, going to join us. He is going to discuss something from his perspective, a collection that he has done, and some work that he does throughout the country. And he's going to tell you how you can possibly at some point have him come to your hometown and look at this wonderful exhibit that he does, that he has been doing for the Library of Congress. And so it it gives us a real interesting perspective that I think that all of us should have. We live in a time sometimes where I know a lot of us ask the question, well, why are you going to talk about that kind of stuff? That's long gone. It's no longer around anymore. Well, I beg to differ. We still live in a period and a time where people still relate and refer to African Americans particularly in very negative ways, in ways that are demeaning. And so we ask the question sometimes, where does that come from? We have a president that sits in the Oval Office currently that recently called an African American woman a dog and a lowlife. And it's some of the same spirit that we saw in some of these early caricatures and some of these things that we hear and some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to be listening to a collection of music that has been saved so that to make sure that we don't forget. That's what history is. But not only that, it's an artistic approach as well. The gentleman tonight is going to be looking at it from an artistic position. But at the same time, as we well know, art is also political, and we will make sure that we help you explain that. We want you to call in and ask questions. Our call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832, and I repeat, 215-490-9832. So if you are listening right now via the internet and you would like to call and make comments, ask questions, by all means do so. Well, I'm not going to prolong with a lot of preliminary discussion. We want to get right into this, and I want to introduce this young man to you, a wonderful young man. But as you know, in the Black Reality Think Tank, one of the things that we always do is we honor our ancestors. We do an ancestral profile every week of someone whose people, whose shoulders that we stand on. In the words of the great Fannie Lou Hamer, she says, "You must always praise the bridges that brought you over. You must always praise the bridges that brought you over." And so we do that. And so we have a recent ancestor that I am going to talk about just for a second, not long, not detailed. Most of you know this particular ancestor very well. It is on the tip of our tongues. It's been there for the last couple of weeks. And she was better known as the Queen of Soul, Miss Aretha Franklin, who transitioned at the age of 76 years old. Ms. Franklin, as you know, was a church-trained pianist and organist who often accompanied herself on recordings and in concert. Mrs. Franklin, thanks to her powerful, flexible voice and fierce delivery, was the most commanding and influential vocalist of her generation. When Ms. Franklin left out a gospel wail or added an, "Oh, yes, I am," as a spiritual feel, her songs became urgent messages and awakened the emotions of anyone with a heart. Ms. Franklin's longtime publicist, Gwendolyn Quinn, confirmed to all that on last Thursday morning at her home in Detroit, she passed away with pancreatic cancer. And so we just want to just shout out to Aretha. We did not have the chance to do that on last week, but we will wanted to do that tonight. And we wanted to make sure that we let the world know that the Black Reality Think Tank is extremely, extremely sensitive and understanding of this great and powerful African woman, Aretha Franklin. Want to just also mention that, you know, the Black Reality Think Tank does air on Saturdays as well from 4 to 6 on the Blog Talk Radio Network system. We're on every Saturday from 4 to 6, so you can catch us there, too. You can go to our Facebook page at the Black Reality Think Tank, and you can see the list of our programs. Also, that is where you can find the archive for most of the things that we do. Our program tonight will be on the archive there on sometime probably next day or so. And you can go and re-listen to our program again and be able to get any points. And if you have any questions, you can just simply email us there at the Facebook page, at the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page, and we'll be glad to answer you immediately. Okay, Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, at the Black Reality Think Tank, we have a wonderful gentleman. His name is Mr. Bill Dockett. Bill Dockett. And that's a very familiar name to some of you folks that are maybe just a little bit of your senior years. This is not that Bill Dockett, but it is a relationship. And he can tell you about that as he begins to talk. But we want to talk about him because he has a wonderful project that he's doing. He is a well-respected and published historian, archivist, and lecturer who specializes in African-American performing arts history. In 2015, Mr. Dockett was commissioned by the Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress to produce a project on race and early sound recordings for the National Jukebox. And he can explain to you what the National Jukebox is. With the Sound Archive specialized in race, Bill Dockett and a gentleman by the name of Tim Brooks share a specialization on race and early sound. Bill Dockett has a cum laude Bachelor of Arts degree in political science from UCLA and has been recognized for his leadership in utilizing history and the arts in creating intergenerational dialogue within and across the Bay Area communities by former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, Berkeley Mayor Tom Bates, and State Senator Mark Lino. Dockett was the 2012 recipient of the Heritage Keepers Award for exhibitions, curation, and archives presented by the Bay Area Friends of Negro Spirituals. And he has been a featured presenter in the annual Bay Area-wide San Francisco History Days and the annual talk series of the Friends of San Francisco's Public Library Citywide Black History Month events. He is the great-grandson of Richmond, Virginia captive Africans, Abby and Henry Clark, who were two of the founders of Richmond's historic Sixth Mount Zion Baptist Church in 1867, and he is the great-nephew of Mary Frances Clark, the first African-American registered nurse in Richmond, Virginia, who graduated in the class of 1900 from the Reconstruction-era Freedmen's Bureau, which eventually was part of the Freedmen's Hospital at Howard University. So, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have this wonderful and brilliant historian, Mr. Bill Dockett, who is going to talk a little bit about his music and his collection and what he has done, saved, and a lot of why it was necessary to do this and what is the value that it would have in the upcoming years. So at this point, I'd like to introduce you, ladies and gentlemen, to Mr. Bill Dockett. He is out of Oakland, California, and he is here with us tonight. Good afternoon, good evening, Mr. Dockett. How are you?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. Thank you so much for having me. Yes. What a joy.
Thank you. Thank you. So why don't you just start? What we're going to do, I'm going to let you take the lead and give us the introduction to what you do and why you do it and so forth. And then
right.
I know we have some clippings that we want to play, and I have that ready and launched. So whenever you give me the cue, I can start those. But meanwhile, why don't you just give your listening audience a little taste of what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Right. Thank you. Yes. So for my audience, I'm Bill Dockett, and yes, I am related to the well-known or legendary rock and roll R&B jazz organist, Bill Dockett. That is my uncle, my father's older brother. My father was the late Reverend John N. Dockett, Jr. Many of you may have heard of him out of St. Louis. He was the president of the St. Louis NAACP at its height in the 70s and early 80s. But what I am doing is chronicling the importance of looking at how we understand and came to understand race through technology. Technology plays a huge role in the creation through the generations since at least 1900 of how we see race, how we feel race, how we even, this notion this idea that is talked about, has been talked about for the past, let's say 5 years, of implicit bias, implicit racial bias, the idea of just having a sense of I don't like something, or how did I come not to like this, or prejudge someone. All of this has sourcing that relates to technology, the technology at the turn of the century, the 20th century, of course. And we're talking about, I call it the iPod, the iPhones, the iPads of 1900 to 1905. And those are the phonograph machine, the phonograph records, early film, like silent film, and then new technological advancements in newspaper presses, which allowed, I'm going to say publishers like the very famous Bay Area publisher, William Randolph Hearst, mm-hmm. famous for his, before the National Enquirer, famous for his yellow journalism or his sensationalized journalism. That's when you hear the term yellow journalism, it of course relates to anti-Asian, anti-Chinese, angles on the news. I think yellow journalism is perhaps the best way to talk about it. It is fake news, if you will, of 1890s to 1900. Well, these technological inventions or an advancement, again, the phonograph record, silent film, and the newspaper improvements for rapid creation of faster presses, et cetera, and faster ways to get out fake news or yellow journalism, really defined our understanding in many ways and how we see race. Mm-hmm. So what's particularly interesting about the phonograph and phonograph record and what we're going to talk about tonight is that these technological advances, these particular machines, the phonograph in particular, were the new toys, if you will, for a whole generation of well-to-do white Americans. These are coming around. This is first we'll talk about the Edison cylinder, and then there's a series of other companies that got copyrighted, their versions of cylinders. But the most famous is the Edison cylinder. It came in various different time lengths, 1 minute, 2 minute, and longer. And then, of course, the flat disc. The flat disc are the discs that we come to know. Many of you who grew up, let's say, in the 50s or 40s, remember your parents and your aunts and uncles had these breakable 78 RPM records. Well, the flat disc was usually at 78 RPM, sometimes at 80, played at 80. But these flat disc recordings became, if you will, the first iTunes, if you will, of this new technology. And they were mass produced and commercialized. That by itself is not a problem. What the problem is, and I wouldn't say the problem, what the issue is for Black Americans historically and for people that are archivists in particular and sound archivists, is that these recordings put into wax, concretized into wax, an idea about Blackness that was not necessarily authentically Black, but rather an imitation of life. We've heard that term. It's a very famous title to a series of, well, to a movie. The first one, of course, you know, with Freddie Washington from the early 30s, talking about something being an imitation of reality. Well, many of these recordings were actually done by artists who were very popular in their day. These artists were representing perhaps the most popular and over-the-top obsessively entertainment in America between the 1880s, especially the 1890s, all the way right until, let's say, right around World War I, so 1915, 16, 17, and that's minstrelsy. And this blackface minstrelsy, putting white gentlemen, white comedians, white vaudevillians who were popular on the American musical and comedy stages of this period of 1880s through, let's say, 1900, 1905, 10, their best skits became, if you will, the first iTunes or the first recordings that were commercializing this idea about Blackness. But this was not Blackness done by Black people necessarily, but an idea about Blackness that is of course, highly stereotyped. But this there was some, and I still, as in all my research, I still sometimes look at this and say, what? Why was white America so obsessed with this notion of this mockery and this exaggeration, this imitation of life, if you will, of black people? And I should point out historically that these images, the image that is put into recorded sound, that's put into silent film, that also is put into cartoons and early newspapers, let's say newspapers, many of which I have, it's a really rare material, from 1900 to 1915, is all based on this icon, this iconic, I'm going to say this iconic idea of what black was defined pre-Civil War. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? The idea is that captured Africans, I'm going to use Dr. Rogers' idea, or I can call them enslaved Africans, become Negro slaves or African-American slaves, were lionized by comedians and entertainers, street entertainers, in the 1830s. This is very important that it's not talked about as much, but it should be talked about before we go in before we go into listening to some of the recordings. This sets the stage for everything that's to come, even in our time today, especially in the Trump era. What am I talking about? I'm talking about in the 1830s, the first wave of Irish immigrants came to New York and other areas, very famously to the Lower Bowery area of New York City. Many of these young men were adventurous and were street entertainers in their native Dublin and other places in Ireland. They did street entertainment for money, for pocket change, that was based on mockery of English aristocracy. When they arrived in the early 1830s in New York and in other places in the early young, you know, United States of America, many of them had the opportunity to become acquainted with other street entertainers who happened to be free blacks, or I hate to use this term, but at that time in the 1830s, 40s, would have been what we commonly call runaway slaves. There were opportunities for many of these Irish entertainers to commingle with some of the black street entertainers who themselves were doing mockery, if you will, of their slave masters. So one particular Irish gentleman who is, if you will, the great-grandfather, the creator of this idea of minstrelsy, his name is Thomas D. Rice. He's very active in the early to mid 1830s. He has this Saturday Night Live idea to mix this, to co-mix, if you will, his historic use of mockery of English aristocracy with the free black or runaway slave idea of mocking, slave plantation aristocracy, if you will, but adds to it this idea of putting on his face burnt cork. His putting on his face this darkening color of burnt cork allows him to create a mask. This is a term that will come up over and over in the literature and in even as currently, and I'm talking about the turn of the 20th century, and very importantly, in W. D. Boyce's landmark Souls of Black Folk, talking about the issue of double consciousness and the mask. Well, the idea of the mask actually is sourced from T.D. Rice in Lower Bowery, Manhattan, in the 1830s, where this Irish gentleman has put on this mask to create an idea, a new idea about blackness that becomes larger than life. And that sells out shows. Not that it's authentic at all, but it's his own, if you will, Saturday Night Live skit. But he becomes larger than life. And then other people start doing it. And then you have a whole host of white entertainers who become minstrels, who then don on this burnt cork to act as if they are, you know, African-American, well, or Negro, as the term was at that time. And it creates this whole, I'm going to call this whole repertoire, if you will, of what black is. One of the most important parts of that, early parts of that repertoire, is Jim Crow. The character of Jim Crow is the happy-go-lucky slave, male slave. It's a male identity in most of these images of what blackness is all about. Jim Crow becomes this happy-go-lucky, stupid, happy to sing and be, you know, to please the master character. And then a second character evolves, which is Zip Coon. Both of these are male characters. Both of these are quote-unquote male slaves. But Zip Coon is considered, is really the caricature of the free slave. Excuse me, the free black, I should say. It's the, you know, the it in fact is the illustrated character, I'm going to say, from 1835 to 1845. Of the gentleman who plays in the movie 13 Years a Slave, of the, you know, the more cultured African American or the more cultured free black, becomes his caricature as well by these Irish minstrels. So by the time that Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin is published in about, what, 1854, you have this idea and this imagery, this caricature of life, this imitation of life already out there, produced by white men, that becomes, if you will, both of these caricatures become, I'm going to call them places for fighting, ideological fighting between pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces or the abolitionists. That these two caricatures are held up as authentic African Africanism or African ideas. These are real. However, obviously they were never real. There was never any field research other than the opportunity in many cases, and specifically with T.D. Rice, who begins it all, if you will, to meet other African-American street entertainers who were doing the similar kind of mockery, but that does not necessarily authenticate the fact that this was the true I'm going to say, cultural identity of enslaved Africans in the Deep South in 1830, 1840, 1850, before the Civil War. So it's a very interesting construct. And then you add to it one of the iconic American composers of this period who began to write songs for these shows, with iconic imagery in the lyrics that basically I'm going to call, what would I say, essentially idealizes, in a romanticizes,
right.
The quality and the experience of white plantation gentry, if you will. And his name, of course, is Stephen Foster. Mm-hmm. Oh, Susanna, I dream of Jeannie with the dark brown hair, masses in the cold, cold ground, old folks at home, Swanee, River. All of these songs romanticize the world of the plantation with happy, you know, happy darkies and happy slaves. Right. That's all a part of this minstrel experience, which becomes darker after the Civil War in particular. But that is interesting and maybe has not been talked about, but these two dueling male Negro characters, Jim Crow and the famous song Jumping Jim Crow and Zip Coon, become the debate at the time of Abraham Lincoln as to which way the country. So it's a very interesting thing to look at. But these characters and these caricatures are really critical at the turn of the century and at the development of this new technology, because the minstrel shows that began in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s before the Civil War continue after the Civil War, and particularly during and after Reconstruction. Reconstruction is being defined essentially 1865 to about, I think, the early 1880s. This particular idea about the African or Negro male becomes the basis for the entertainment of white America mm-hmm. on American musical theater stage and comedy, in particular for comedy. And those particular ideas and those skits that are done by well-known white entertainers in particular, as well as the black ones, but in particular, it was the white ones in blackface that were, they were commissioned, if you will, or even perhaps better way of putting it, signed by the record companies of the era of the 1890s through the early 1900s. Victor, Edison, Columbia, they were signed to these record labels to put into wax their best skits, their best, in other words, their greatest hits. And their greatest hits were all about these ideas about black men and black culture as something to laugh at. And that's where the issue comes in and the problem comes in around implicit bias as we go forward in this. But I just wanted to, that's a very important to give you this background and understanding of why we are, how it came to pass and where we are. So I'm going to let Dr. Rogers come in now.
That's perfect. I mean, that's exactly what we need. I want to just ask something real quick. I don't want to cut you off because I want you to get back to telling that part. I just want to ask, how did the whole idea of archiving these things with the Library of Congress generate? Where does that come from? Was that your initiative, or was it something that they felt that they needed to do? Just how did that happen?
I'm happy to answer that. My coming to their attention was through the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, the national nonprofit service organization of the major institutions that have recorded sound collections, like the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, and universities like Yale, Rutgers, the Stanford, UCLA. Leading organizations that have an annual conference. I was invited in 2014 to do a presentation titled Emancipation Proclamation from Minstrelsy and Coon Songs to Negro Spirituals in Chapel Hill. I had no idea that presentation would be so well received and that there would be so many people from the Recorded Sound Division as well as the Motion Picture Division of the Library of Congress in that room that I presented in. Also, I had no idea that they had been looking for someone like me for a long time because of the fact that they wanted, I'll just say, they, and in particular at that time in 2014-15, my boss, or boss-to-be, Gene Deanna, who's now retired, I was head of the Recorded Sound Division, they were looking for an African-American person specifically who could do a very nuanced pilot that looked at the darkness of early recorded sound and presented in a way that allowed it to breathe and allowed people to be able to come to their own conclusion rather than to look at it through such a dark lens with blinders on. So that's how it came to pass. I was fortunate, we were all fortunate, that at that time, in 2014, 15, 16, that I just so happened to have this major archive, early sound archive, all focused on race. So all of the major commercial recordings, I'm going to say specifically, most of them were Columbia and Victor recordings, and many of the earliest Columbia recordings, flat disc recordings of 1900, 1902, or 3, 4, were all actually originally cylinder recordings. Cylinder recordings that were done, let's say, as early as 1890. Usually they were introduced, they had spoken introduction, and then the song was done, or if it's a spoken word, then the skit was done. I have a large and very impressive archive of this material, which made, the case for me that much stronger. So that's how it came to pass.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, the timing of it was coinciding with the election of 2016 in terms of trying to get this launched and finished. There are other aspects, and this was all done, I should say, very importantly. This project or pilot, like a TV pilot, mm-hmm. the series was done for the National Jukebox, which is the recorded sound division of the Library of Congress's online face to the world. It's a major, I don't have the web address for you, but if you Google the National Jukebox, you'll come to it. It's a major portal for sound recording, and it's focused heavily on early sound. There are thousands of recordings that have been remastered and organized, etc. This was for the National Jukebox. Unfortunately, Donald Trump became president, and with that, on his coattails came all of this white supremacy alt-right and a series of racial hate crimes. So I think, in all fairness to the Library of Congress, that there was some concern about timing and about launching this with all this backdrop going on. So eventually, I think it will be launched, but it's a very it's an impressive pilot. Just like TV pilots, I likened it to that. When CBS or NBC has a sitcom, that someone has a sitcom that they shopped and, it's got green-lighted and they go into development, or go into, shooting. They have, they have the cameraman, they've got the actors, they've got the director, everything's great and it's in the can. And everyone says, oh, this is a great series, a great sitcom series. We're looking forward to launching it in the fall. Okay. And then somewhere along the line, someone else higher up says, no, I don't think so. And you have this whole wonderful opportunity. So, it's just what it is. But the good news is that I have continued to talk about the subject and to revitalize it. Authentically that it is a suppressed topic. Mm-hmm. No one is mm-hmm. talking about the importance of how these early mass-produced recordings, commercialized recordings that were created to sell these new iPhones, the Victrola, the phonograph. These recordings were done by white people for the consumption of well-to-do white Americans who could afford these expensive machines that were often in large, credenzas, furniture pieces. African-Americans who were, African-Americans who were still, no more than 25 to 30 years from the Civil War and from the Emancipation Proclamation, many of them were still, many of their lives were restricted by the Black Codes and Jim Crow, et cetera, but many of them were sharecroppers. Or domestics, they didn't have the money to afford these kinds of machines. And the entertainment that was put into wax was not for them, for their consumption, but was for those who could afford these fancy machines and for their enjoyment. It also was a reflection, this is very important to talk about, it was a reflection of the reigning entertainment of the time. What was popular? Right. What was the most popular? Was the minstrel show and the caricature of black men in particular. That had been in sheet music, that had been on the American musical stage, and not just white men in blackface, but also outstanding African Americans who were entertainers, like Ernest Hogan, who was a very important figure. There's not enough time to talk about all the different players, but Ernest Hogan in particular, Burt Williams, those two in particular, and then other entertainers who were composers like Bob Cole and J. Rossman Johnson. They were creating songs that were stereotypical, but I think they couldn't. The challenge was at that time was that in order to survive as an entertainer, that was what selling. That's what you had to do. Irving Jones, a black vaudevillian or minstrel, mm-hmm. wrote The Dangerous Black Man Black Man. I think it's called The Dangerous Black Man, a song sheet with a very, I have in my collection the image of it, which is pretty amazing. There are other songs that he wrote. He's African American writing these songs, mm-hmm. and they're mostly published by white New York music houses, and these houses make a fortune mm-hmm. on this negativity, if you will, for our times. And negativity, I think, still for their times, but it wasn't seen that way because black people really didn't have a say financially in the industry, if you will. You know, we were still dealing with the shadow of slavery and the shadow of and the reality of the Black Code.
Right.
And the dawn of the Ku Klux Klan and all of the restrictions. And then, of course, later, I think Plessy versus Ferguson, the Jim Crow, the Supreme Court decision, I think that's what, 1893, we're dealing with that. So none of this material was for our consumption, but it was for white consumption. And it has a mm-hmm. huge impact on implicit bias, on race consciousness, on how we see race. And that's the work that I'm doing.
Right.
So let's go forward to listen to perhaps the first recording.
Okay. All right. One quick question I want to ask you just real quickly, just for say our brothers and sisters, meaning our listening audience, who might have a little skepticism about saying, well, what is the value of us knowing about this music and all of this history? What can we take away from this? How would you articulate an answer to an individual that might raise that question?
That's not hard at all for me to do. The value is knowing our history and understanding how we got to where we are today.
Okay.
These recordings, and I do multimedia lectures and presentations at universities and colleges and just in general, and please feel free to consider that. These recordings speak to the heart of what is behind Charlottesville, and we're just commemorating the anniversary of Charlottesville, as well as to the dog whistles in all the Trump rallies, as well as to taking a look even at how contemporary TV media impacts our understanding of race, looking at, Archie Bunker and All in the Family, compared to the recent Roseanne Barr, the Roseanne Barr reboot show, and looking at, comparing that, juxtaposing that to Daniel Glover's well-known and controversial 2018 music video, This Is America. All of these ideas about blackness are part of our current conversation, even if we don't think it is.
Okay.
These recordings, which have been lost to time, have created, if you will, an intergenerational foundation in entertainment. It's these recordings from 1900, 1924, all the way through 1920 and beyond that essentially concretize and become concretized in motion picture and in TV. I'm going to say motion picture. I mean, this is what I'm going fast forward in my conversation of what I wanted to talk about today. But when you look at the blockbuster of cinema of 1915, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, that's a glorification of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
It is amazing. And then you go forward to the silent 1926. Actually, it's considered the first talkie. Excuse me, it's not the first talkie, but it is. Let me be clear, because I don't want to lose people. The first talkie is associated with Al Jolson. It's called the Jazz Singer from 1927. Before the Jazz Singer, Al Jolson did something called Plantation Act in 1926. It technically is the first talkie or sound film. That film has Al Jolson, a Jewish man in blackface, mimicking a male slave on a plantation setting with cotton and roosters. That's 1926. Then you go to 1927, I believe it's 27 or 29, I'm not sure, I'm on top of my head. You go to Showboat, the Lenley, which is became Universal Studios, the silent version of Showboat. And then you go, of course, famously to the sound version, the 1936 Universal version of Showboat, which features Paul Robeson and, of course, famously in Old Man River. What is that followed by? 1939, Mitchell's, what I'm going to say, I think it's Margaret Mitchell's, again, iconic, romanticized notion of the pre-Civil War South called Gone with the Wind. Mm. It is the 1915 Birth of a Nation blockbuster juxtaposed to the 1939 Gone with the Wind cinematic blockbuster, both of which are idealizing white and romanticizing the lost cause of the Confederacy, of life before the Civil War, of how gallant and how, the gallantry of the, you know, of the, you know, of the life. You know, you look at Scarlett O'Hara, how her life was, and you look at Hattie McDaniel, and you look at how everything was in place perfectly. That is what these recordings relate to. And those recordings, especially the comedic recordings, become the foundation, unfortunately, tragically, for black comedy in the 40s and 50s with Manta and Moreland, with Eddie Rochester Anderson, and then in the early 50s, in the mid-50s, with Amos and Andy. Right. Not the white, blackface Amos and Andy of the 20s or 30s that were in movies and on radio, but right, actually the black Amos and Andy's who were on early TV and whose time was up by that time because of the dawn of the Civil Rights Movement. So that's my answer, and I think,
okay,
I think it's pretty good.
Fantastic. Okay, let's get started. Here we go. Here's our first one.
Oh, my, what is that?
Why, that am a monkey and his sweetheart up in that tree is spooning.
Is that so? What did he say to her?
Oh, he says, does you love me?
Oh. Well, what did she say?
Why, she says, I'm not prepared to answer.
They're talking again. What did he say then?
Why, he says, will you marry me?
Well, did she say yes?
No, she said, you'll have to ask my papa something.
Oh, my goodness, what was that?
Why, that was her papa.
And that's her papa? What's the matter? Am he mad?
No. He was only just giving them his blessing.
Well, I do hope he'll overlook us.
I hope so, too, gal.
Moonlight in jungle land. Moonlight and love in the jungle. Baby, monkey, native, somebody special love. Lovely Miss Kangaroo, home from the sand. With a chimpanzee, her in the sea, with moonlight in jungle land.
Of course, that is an amazing, it's a snippet of a longer recording. It's called Moonlight in Jungle Land. It's a Victor recording from 1910, recorded by the two most famous and iconic voices in minstrelsy in recorded sound at this time, Collins and Harlan, Arthur Collins and Byron Harlan. They are two white men, both Irish, who are on recording. I don't think they really do a lot of onstage material, but they lionize the idea about black voicing by white men, if you will. They were often thought to be Negro, but actually they were white, but they had this stunning ability to imitate black voicing in all of their recordings. And also I should say, it is very important because you heard the kind of male and female idea here. What were they doing? This was typical of American musical theater at vaudeville and the minstrel show, where there was a skit, a duet, where there would be a male, and then there would be a female. They're both men, but one that takes on the female role. Usually on the theater stage, they're usually dressed as a woman. So this idea of being in drag did not start in the 60s with Flip Wilson, but it actually existed on American musical theater stages of 1900, all the way, I guess, basically through 1910 or later. But Combs and Harlan, this recording, of course, what can we say, of course, about this recording? It's called Moonlight in Jungle Land. How iconic and how relating to today and to Dr. Rogers talking about how Donald Trump called Omarosa a dog. Okay, how do we look at in 1910, we have African-Americans, even like a W. Du Bois or Booker T. Washington, thought as coons in a jungle. How many times have we heard the stereotype of blacks being from a jungle or in the jungle? And then, of course, there's a animal like a monkey in the tree called the coon. You clearly heard that in that excerpt. Perhaps it passed the censors, and I use that as a television term, you know, not passing the censors. I think at that time, in that generation, there weren't enough censors to realize that that might be offensive. Certainly it's not politically correct, but I think the entire repertoire of early sound, especially the narrative material that I have that will come up, which we'll listen to later, called Darky Stories, is just stunning. And it's stunning to pose the question, the rhetorical question, why were there no censors thinking that this might be offensive material? So that's an interesting story. But yes, that's the first. And that's, I think we're hearing maybe one more Collins and Harlan, but that's typical of Collins and Harlan's material. So,
okay,
I'm done.
Here's your next song.
I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, we can take questions after this. Comment on that one, or you want to skip?
Yes, I did. Yes, of course, I'm going to comment on that.
Okay.
That is a very famous and iconic song called "Carry Me Back to Old Virginia." This is particularly an interesting song for a variety of reasons. Not only because it is, or was, if you will, the state song for the state of Virginia for many years, but more controversially, this is a song written by James Bland, an African-American man, likely I don't know all of his history, whether he was actually a free black, but I believe probably an ex-slave. He's writing a song that romanticizes the idea about Virginia and Virginia plantation life. You know, what are the lyrics? In particular, "Carry me back to old Virginia, the land where the corn, cotton, and taters grow. Carry me back you know, where the old darkies long to go. As in, somehow, this song was written way after the Civil War, but yet it is nostalgic for a time long gone with the wind. And that becomes controversial, but also this sets up this particular song. I should speak to this recording. This is a recording, an early Columbia recording from about 1902. It's originally a cylinder. So as I said before, that many of these, the first recordings, many of which are announced, this one was not announced, are actually cylinders from the 1890s that were re-licensed for flat discs. So this one really is typical of the recordings at the turn of the century that, or, and the recordings in the new technology, because if you frame it that way, and looking at the phonograph as the iPhone of its era, as the toy for wealthy white people, if you will, not for black people, but for wealthy white people, that the recordings made to sell, and I'm going to repeat that, the recordings that were commercially made, mass-produced to sell these machines, all concretized this idea about blackness and race that's part of the lost cause and the Confederacy. It's an amazing thing. So I'm happy. I don't know what you want to do next. I'm happy to continue with the third or to take questions.
Let's see if we have some questions thus far. And then we can keep going right with your recordings. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. We have a wonderful guest today, Mr. Bill Doggett. Mr. Doggett is a historian. He is an archivist and a lecturer specializing in African-American performing arts history. And he is talking about a wonderful collection of music that is now a part of the National Jukebox for the Library of Congress. And he is sharing some of the collection with us and giving us the background and the history of that music. So let's go to our audience and see if there are some questions. I have a brother here from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Brother Timothy, how are you doing this afternoon? Any questions for Brother Doggett?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Dr. Rogers. You hit another home run. You have a great guest.
Thank you.
Mr. Doggett, I'm interested in the subject that you talk about. I happen to be a musician and a bass guitar player, and I'm also into film. And 3 months ago, I was in a place called San Leandro in the Bay Area. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that, between Oakland and San Francisco, and I had a wonderful time.
Great. Wonderful.
Yes, I'm going to tell you, sir, that one of the most important courses I ever had in graduate school was film theory and criticism. And I'm going to say this, sir, that I have an uncle who has one of those old recorders, the furniture of it, and it's just a beautiful piece of art. And you wind it, and it needs some work because the needle is no longer around. But all of us want to grab it if anything ever happens to him. That's how important it is. Let me get on with this, sir. I'm going to say this, that when we look at that era of buffoonery and things of that nature, and we look at what was going on in the South and what's reflected at that time period, I have to say that we've come a long way, but we haven't. So if you look at a Hattie McDaniels, who was in Going with the Wind, or if you ever looked at Spike Lee's movie Bamboozle, and if we look at in the 20s, when we were real, doing real good in film as independent filmmaker with the Miu Sim, the Yusuf Muntaz, the Jax, how creative we were in that era. And if we go back to what they were doing during that time period with buffoonery, I have to say this, that this past weekend, I saw Smokey Robinson live. I'm pretty sure he flew from California here. And he was giving us a history of Motown when he was there in 62 when it began. And he talked about the Motown Review and what he went through to get his records producing, how he was at one time vice president of it, Barry being the president, who all he wrote for and things of this nature. And, sir, I'm going to tell you this. There was an audience of black and white people. I think there were more white people there than black people. Now, whether that is the introduction of hip-hop, well, that's controversial. But I will say this much, that of all we've been through with film and music, I have to say that Motown set a precedence for us that when Barry went from records and writing and recordings, he went from that to movie production. And I think he set a paradigm, a base for, like Du Bois talk about, what is the criteria of art? We have a standard to put in our music and film to uplift our race, specifically to make it the best that we can. I'm going to say that because they have something out called, I think it's called the Housewives of the Civil Rights Movement. If you ever see that, you want these new rappers that are out in entertainment to be ashamed of themselves. And what they do, these women display the wives. Someone is Coretta Scott King. Someone is Betty Shabazz. Someone is Rosa Parks. And they make these negative, they know better than this. They make these negative things and talk about Martin Luther King's life with, on the outside of his marriage. It was nobody's business. He was out there fighting for people. Him and Malcolm, they died poor. And they were slaughtered like animals. So we have to stay on the right track. Now, during some time period, like Bojangles may have did what he had to do during that time period. But today, we should be able to twist this thing when we look at the perfection of film and music. We should be making those mistakes these days. We're playing with race and rights. And people and politics, black people should be on the focus of going straight in the movement with perfection.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, brother.
Indeed.
Okay.
Indeed.
Let's go over to Newport News, Virginia. Brother Griffin.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, sir. And, how are you?
And Dr. Doggett.
I'd
like him to spell his last name for me because I want to do some research after I finish with this.
My last name is D as in David, O-G-G-E-T-T. And my website, if you want, is my name, Bill Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, productions, with an S, .com. You have to look at it on a laptop or desktop and preferred open it with Google Chrome, as opposed to Firefox, so that it performs. There's a lot of content, so it performs best on Google Chrome. But yeah, that's my last name. What is your comment?
Good. I want to pivot because actually I learned to read at an early age, and you were talking about James Bland and all that. I'm from Yorktown, Virginia. I started reading at an early age, and my aunt, I had a great uncle and a great aunt that actually had two of these Victrolas. And I used to go up because their eyesight was going bad. They had operated some stores around here in Yorktown. And they actually also, my grandfather ran a little juke joint that year. And so even though I was very young, because I had good eyes, they let me play some of the music for them. They passed away when I got about 10 years old. But what I was going to say to you is when talking about James Bland, James Bland wrote over 700 songs. So I heard Brother Timothy chime in. I actually got to talk to them when I was young, which really kept me into a lot of history and stuff. So when you started talking about the recordings and all of that, when I would listen to some of those songs and I'd hear words, you know, that I thought were offensive, and they used to tell me all the time, boy, we were trying to make a living. Nobody had time to worry about the words. But I want to switch to the other part is, I learned early on that that medium was also used to do basically what you were saying early on. It set the mindset on how to view black people.
That's right.
And it was really, and that's true to this day. The very same thing is going on with Wakanda. The very same thing is going on with some of the stuff that Spike Lee did with his latest movie. And people keep just saying it's just entertainment, it's just entertainment. But it lays a foundation for how you view people. And because of our unique, peculiar position here in this country, white people see us and they don't see us as individuals because all of that foundation has been laid for them in the music. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that's what you were pointing to when you were talking about how the white people were doing all that. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but this is a very enjoyable thing, and I'm going to go to your website and try to dig in it a little bit more. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And yes, I'll respond to your comment and question. Yeah. I'm fortunate to have a wonderful early sound archive from essentially 1900 through the mid 50s, but specifically the focus on race and race consciousness is the area of 1900 to 19, I'm going to say 1930. Those recordings are amazing. And many of the recordings I have, some of the rarer items, were from like your grandmother or your aunt's or grandfather's collections. I'm not talking about you specifically, but of coming from African American homes that had Victrolas, that maybe the tabletop, the smaller, less expensive ones, and especially had them during the time of the 20s, before the Great Depression, so let's say before 1929, where they bought what was at that time called a race record. So the blues, in particular like Bessie Smith and a whole bunch of other people, they were very popular. But of course, many of these recordings, because many of these, the copies that I have coming from these sources, show the age. Because during this time period, especially after 1929, during the Depression, blacks were hit the hardest economically. So, you know, they didn't have necessarily the money for fresh needles. So many of them used nails and other things, or worn out needles. So many of these rare recordings are worn, but I can relate to what you're saying with the Victrolas. So what I want to say is simply, in addition to that comment, is that, of course, and very importantly, the ideas about racial and implicit bias today are all sourced, it's almost seemingly across generations, by not only these recordings, but by what these recordings then enable. Mm-hmm. That's very important. I'm going to say this again. What these recordings enable and empower is an idea, an icon. An iconography about blackness,
right,
that then is translated into motion picture. Mm-hmm. And it's the motion picture in particular that becomes the device for implicit bias, because if you live in a small town in Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, wherever it is, and you've never met a black person, you've seen them on TV. Excuse me. You've seen them on motion picture on the big screen, especially once movies changed from silent to sound in 1929. So, if you grew up in the period of 1929 to 1939, the idea about blackness was already heavily defined, based on the stereotypes from the 1830s and 40s, as well as all of the stereotypes about blacks during the Civil War, post-Civil War, concretized by ex-Confederate states who were invested in having this idea about blackness and about the black slave be essentially immortalized, if I can use that word, immortalized. And, of course, not immortalized positively, but immortalized negatively. So these recordings are significant to understand. But we, of course, need to lift up the positive things that are out there. And I can perfectly segue. We won't hear this recording tonight. But the first African-American to make a record was George W. Johnson. He was very famous at the turn of the century, before the turn of the century, actually, for his whistling skills. By the time he made his first recordings around 1900, he was a little bit past his prime. But what's significant about the two George W. Johnson recordings I have is that you listen to these two recordings and then you juxtapose them to Collins and Harlan and others of this time, you would never know George W. Johnson was African-American. He sounds as bland and as normal as you could imagine. He sounds like a human being. I hate to go there like that, but he sounds as normal as you and I would sound. But his recordings were not the ones that would sell lots of records and make Victor or Columbia or Edison rich.
it was the stereotyped idea of black humor or black voicing that became the foundation for this vast repertoire of recorded what's called darky stories. That, you know, and that Victor by 1910, 1912 began to put sub labels on the record saying darky story or coon song. But actually they did coon song actually at the very beginning, 1900 to 1905, all of the recordings that were a comedic, or even just songs, just either comedic songs, duets, or just simple songs, had, you know, the icon coon song in parentheses, so that people who were presented at the phonograph or furniture store with this beautiful new furniture piece that happened to contain a phonograph, had the opportunity to buy records for their new piece, for their new machine, but they had to kind of know what they are. So the coon song or darky stories helped identify the nature of the recording that they were going to buy. But all of these recordings were commercially done. These were mass produced, and mass produced for white audiences, not for black audiences. So that's the controversy there. That then and now, and there's more to that, and it immediately follows. So I might as well. I would normally talk about this much later in my conversation, but I'll talk about it now. And that is, it begs a rhetorical question. For 1905, 1910, 1915, especially 1915, which is the year that Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, becomes this cinematic world blockbuster. This the most negative depiction of ex-slaves, now free blacks, that could ever have been made in 1915. You know, this particular idea, all of this music is enabling and empowering motion picture to create and further this idea. So I think that's, I hope this helps answer your question, and thank you very much for your question.
Mr. Griffin, now you had one other point you wanted to make.
The only other comment I wanted to make is Brother Timothy brought up the fact about the white people in the crowd with Smokey. I'm 65 years old, and I want to let him know that is not a new thing. As I was talking about, when I was a kid at 5 to about 9 years old, that little juke joint was still being run. And after 1:30 or 2 o'clock on Friday and Saturday nights, especially during the summer, that I could witness this, and I would have conversations with my great uncle afterwards, white people flocked to that place. Mm-hmm. The same white people, and I'm here in Yorktown, Virginia, and you got to think that this is the early 60s, before civil rights. And those same white people that would come in that juke joint and dance and act a fool and buy their white lightning, when you saw them during the day, you couldn't make eye contact with them or pretend that you knew them. Right. So it reinforced the mindset of the happy Negro when they drunk or whatever. But when you got back out into what civilization or society, you also knew to keep your place. And it made white folks keep on their toes about how they interacted with you.
Yep, that's it.
So I agree with you about setting that mindset and giving them someone to look down on.
Right.
Yep, it's a deep subject. It's one that's this whole idea about race consciousness and implicit bias, the history of implicit bias, and its connection to technology of entertainment, which is what I'm talking about. I framed it since my initial pilot for the National Jukebox. I've moved away from just talking about, you know, the history of, I think my initial title was to basically follow through on the popularity of the Twitter hashtag. So my initial title for the for my Library of Congress Recorded Sound Division pilot was hashtag Black Voices Matter, Race, Music, and Message at the Dawn of Recorded Sound. Mm. But still, that's important. Black voices do matter. But the tragedy at the dawn of recorded sound is the only black voice that was allowed to make a record was in 1900-1912, which George W. Johnson. He sounds as bland as you could be, but he's actually African-American. It's tragic that Columbia in particular, Columbia and Victor are the two leading record companies, flat disc record companies. It's tragic that between 1905 to 1915, Let me revise that. From 1904 to 1912, if you will, both companies spent a tremendous amount of money and resources to record ethnic groups all around the world. Hungarians, Bohemians, people even in Cuba, South America, especially but focused mostly on Europe. Kind of, if you will, setting the tone for records to sell to those coming across the Atlantic and ending up in Ellis Island, all of the immigrants. What they didn't do was spend money and allocate their resources to record the rich, burgeoning jazz scene happening in the South in African-American venues. It wasn't until, I think, 1914, that W.C. Handy's very famous band gets its first recording. But yet you have all of these, from culturally, I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone on the radio. We give value to all cultures, but the indigenous culture of African-American music, specifically jazz,
right,
and perhaps even ragtime, what did not get recorded until much later. I'm going to say much later is 1913, 14, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. James Rhys Europe, his society orchestra. James Rhys Europe is showing up. He's a very important figure I'm going to say from essentially 1910 to his death, I think in 1919, but he's most identified at the dawn of, in the height of ragtime and through the First World War. Mm-hmm. But, there were a lot of other people, like Billy Bolden, who was the famous New Orleans trumpeter. There's supposedly a recording out there, but the opportunity to record Buddy Bolden didn't happen. Fortunately, Louis Armstrong, through King Oliver, had an opportunity, but we're talking about the early 20s.
Right.
What happened? Why was it that African Americans, the singers, maybe a singer previous, maybe before Ma Rainey, before Bessie Smith, before Mamie Smith, Who there certainly were those great black singers who trained them or that they heard, inspired them. Of course, and very famously, a woman who's considered the great grandmother of black opera singers, Sister Rita Joyner Jones, the Black Patty, mm-hmm. was right there at the dawn of recorded sound all the way through that she died in 1937. It is a mystery why this iconic singer never made a record or was never allowed to make a record. I believe there's something more to that story than what has been written, because she was right there. And her voice was famous and across many circles. But it's all very interesting historically to look at. So we should, I guess, go on to the next question or go on to the next song. Which shall we do?
Okay, and we do have some more callers. I'll come back to them after we hear a couple of things. Okay.
So we're next going to Turkey in the Straw.
As I was going down the road with a tired team and a heavy load, my whip and the leader sprung. The old horse busted the wagon tongue. I looked, toot, toot, loot, toot, 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 toot. Went out to milk and I didn't know how. I milked a colt instead of the cow. A monkey sat in a pile of straw. I winked in at his mother-in-law. Turkey
indeed, I know that a nigger do love turkey. Mm-hmm. And I know that a coon do love chicken. Wait, 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 wait. Oh, but give that coon some possum. That's what he wants, and hog chicken. Mm-hmm. Oh, go on. Give him that possum with gravy running down its back. Will make a nigger wench his lips pull in the slack. Well, as I was a-gwine down the road, I met Mr. Toppin and I met Miss Toad. Every time Mr. Toppin would sing, see that old shortcut, the pigeon wing. I look, way down yonder when I touched I loop. I sit in the battle with the kangaroo. I sit in the port till the head's that ground. I hush it up a piece and I take another round. Turkey in the sun, a turkey in the hay. A chicken and turn about a high turkey fall. A hook's mother to call turkey in the straw. A turkey in the mud, New York turkey. A chicken and turn about a high turkey fall. A hook's mother to call turkey in the straw.
That is that is Billy Golden's Turkey in the Straw. That is the 1912 version. There were many versions of this. The version we're hearing tonight is different than the one that I have in my collection. There are actually two different versions. One that's a 1904 version, excuse me, 1906 version. And then there is the, I think, a 1912. And there's also one that's a cylinder, which I believe is 1890. What's significant about this recording, I think, is obvious. This was a huge hit on all of its labels, but in particular for Victor Records. This is considered Billy Golden, an early white, another Irishman, as far as I believe he's Irish. Billy Golden was one of the key blackface vaudevillians, and I want to say he was in theater. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure I'll hear something if I'm wrong on that. But he's famous for his minstrel skits, and I do believe he was in theater, an American musical theater stage, and this was brought. This is one of his greatest hits. Brought to the recorded studio and re-recorded several different times. In this recording of Turkey in the Straw, an iconic Southern bluegrass, now today Southern bluegrass tune, normally an instrumental, very popular and associated, I think, with Kentucky in the South. He adds lyrics. But the lyrics by themselves, the initial part is fine, but he adds to it, to his skit in this recording, this monologue about what a black male or black people in particular like in terms of food, that a nigger, if you will, loves his possum and with gravy running down its back, etc., like that. And then, he has the double voicing. Not just him, but he creates this other, again, like Saturday Night Live voice, the second voicing of this kind of step and fetch it black person saying, oh, yeah, that's what. And in one of the recordings that I had, the one that unfortunately we're not hearing tonight due to a small technical issue, he actually tells the what he calls in this, the black person that he's giving the alternate voice to shut up, because he knows what he wants and likes, as though, so it's an interesting statement, mm-hmm. if nothing more. I mean, it's a huge statement that here you have Billy Golden, one of the celebrated, he's almost simultaneous, but a little bit precedes Colin and Harlan. They're both really almost at the same time, but, one is a little bit more popular in terms of record sales than the other. I would say Billy Golden's career really kind of ends by about 1910, 1911, but Collins and Harlan are still in their heyday.
But what's significant is that this is a greatest hit for Billy Golden. This record sold millions of copies. The record, the song by, and the sheet music also has, is famous at the turn of the century for some pretty negative imagery. But what Billy Golden adds to this is he adds a salutation and a concretizes this notion that an African-American male in particular, or black men in particular, love possum, you know, and this is what they're all about. And this is, so you have the idea of implicit bias already concretized, by this recording. And this recording was done in 1912, but it was actually initially done at the turn of the century in 1900 in an early version. So it's one of several darker recordings that really have been lost to time, but really make the idea of what we were, what this, we would later see in silent film, concretized in particular by 1915 with Birth of a Nation. And then moving forward, of course, and particularly moving forward by 1939 with Gone with the Wind. So that's one of many. There's a recording, I will add to this. There's a recording that was planned for tonight. It's perhaps the most famous Collins and Harlan recording from 1905. It's similar to Turkey in the Straw, but it's darker and particularly strong. We're not able to hear it tonight. I won't even talk about it other than it is amazing.
Okay.
It is extraordinary, but I think we'll move on for now.
Okay. Let's just take a very quick station break. We're going to come right back.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
If you have any questions or comments for our guest tonight, our number is area code 215-490-9832. Again, 215-490-9832. So for any of our internet listening audience, you would like to call, ask a question, you may be welcome you to do so right now. I'm going to go over here to my good friend, Brother Herbie White, from Durham, North Carolina, to see if he has a question or comment. Brother White?
Yes, good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, my brother.
And good evening to your guest.
Yes, sir.
Good evening.
I want to thank this brother from the bottom of my heart. Mm-hmm. Because if you watch white media, they're always preoccupied with discrediting black people. Mm-hmm. So anything that you watch, you know, if you watch television, they'll have the history of comedy, the history of music, the history of that. And in that history, all you're going to get is propaganda. So we have to look for people like this brother to get to the truth about every aspect of what we do and what we've done and what's been done to us to make us look bad. Mm-hmm. Any form of media, of music, or anything, Europeans always co-opt it and bring forth the ugliest part concerning black people. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have people like this brother, we'll never know anything positive about ourselves.
That's right.
And I'd like to thank you, brother, and I'd like to ask him to also give his website again. I didn't have a pen handy before.
Sure. My website. Thank you for your comment. I'm grateful. I'm honored. Thank you so much, sir. My website is Bill Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, productions.com. Again, Bill Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, productions.com. It's got a lot of content on it. It's best open on a laptop or desktop, and specifically with the browser, Google Chrome. If you don't have Google Chrome, you can download it, but this particular website performs best with that as opposed to Firefox or others. But yes, thank you. There's so much to say, but I want to
I want to zoom in on one thing you've talked about. It's the importance of historical media to look at how the role that historical media has played in the understanding and in the communication of ideas about race. And you know, it's historical media, and I want to expand on this just a little bit, because I want to make sure that our listening audience understands I'm not going in the direction of current day talking about the problem of the media. What I'm talking about is something else. It's actually interesting and controversial. Again, pointing to the rhetorical question. Were the executives at Victor Records, Columbia Records, Edison Records, and other record companies circa 1900 through 1910, were they complicit or not complicit in advancing this notion of racial stereotypes? Or were they simply, and this is almost the topic of a symposium on historical media, or were they, these executives, simply signing the most popular artists of the day to put into wax their greatest hits? So, therefore, just mirroring what was popular in American entertainment and in American musical theater stage. I mean, technically, in all fairness to, you know, as an apologist, if you will, one could say that, you know, simply these record executives were just signing these very popular artists to their record labels to make these records because this was the reigning entertainment. This was what was popular. They weren't thinking about the censors. They didn't have, like, TV censors. You know, you can't play this, you can't say this, you can't say that. This was before all of that. Kind of, I'm gonna put it in the Hollywood term. It was pre-code, if you will, the recording. If there was recording companies that were pre-code and post-code, this was the pre-code era where anything goes, or anything went, so to speak. So I think it's very important to look at that. But again, we have to look at the idea of, were they complicit or were they not complicit? But the reality, the upshot, and this I speak to quite a bit, and on my website you can see a segment, a phone video segment, of my recent May 12, 2018 presentation, the closing conference presentation for the Association for Recorded Sound Collections 52nd Annual Conference in Baltimore, Maryland. I was there. I was the conference closing presenter. My topic was # Freddie Gray Baltimore, the problem of blackness, in particular black maleness in early recorded sound. That's on my website, on several different places, on the homepage. Where I'm going with that is we have to embrace the fact that whether we like it or not, these recordings were likely made simply to help them sell phonograph machines. They had to create a body of repertoire, recorded repertoire, that were then put into shellac and made into records to help sell these machines. Mm-hmm. You know, the entertainment was not thought of as being political or problematic, because this was what was popular among white America. These recordings were not made for the consumption of African Americans. And this speaks to something that my peer, and I don't know if he's going to be listening or not, a Caucasian gentleman who's a specialist, a well-known specialist in minstrelsy and early sound, Tim Brooks, who's a VIP at the Association for Recorded Sound Collections. He's in the New York City area. Tim Brooks did a critical book. It's a very large book, a critically received book called Lost Sound, the history of early blacks and blacks in early recordings. What we have to look at is that these recordings were made to sell phonographs, no matter what. Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, and an all tragedy that somehow the whole, if you will, post-Depression era of codes, looking at what was acceptable or not, like codes in the film. you know, pre-code Hollywood had all of this stuff, and then after the Hays Code went into Hollywood, you couldn't show certain things. You couldn't, you know, have certain kind of dialogue. All this risque stuff ended. So in a similar or related way, you have, there's a connection to be made with reported sound. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out just really quickly, if I don't lose a train of my thought, is how important these artists were to be a difficult counterpoint for the movement for social justice of pioneers of social justice like W.E. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Of course, Booker T. Washington and W.E. Du Bois are on, if you will, opposite sides, one being far more progressive and one being more accommodationist. But yet, these recordings were done at the time when they're trying to do racial uplift. Well, you know, racial uplift for the black, for the Negro race, you know, has this counterpoint of all of these mass-produced recordings that white people are listening to and thinking is funny or humorous. But it doesn't allow blackness to be or black people to be taken seriously. And this is the counterpoint that has to be talked about in any discussion of this repertoire. And this entire subject has not been talked about. I don't know why, but it has not been talked about. It's not been written about. I am honored to have been picked by the Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress because through this initial pilot, even though it has not been launched yet for a variety of reasons, has allowed me to shed light on this critical subject.
Right.
So
right.
Thank you for your question.
Okay, let's go to Brother Marcus, Phoenix, Arizona. Brother Marcus, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Brother Dr. Rogers, and good evening to the Brother Dougie. And I appreciate this program. You know, the music that he's talking about, there is a direct correlation with that music and the present music being played today with the rap music, and the same degrading message is being put out by the same people, Columbia Records, Atlantic Records, you see what I'm saying? So it hasn't changed. You see, the time period has changed, but it's the same message. You know, the gangster rap, the Little Wayne, you know, it's the same degrading message.
Right.
You know, calling women bees and calling us, you know, the N-word and selling drugs and, you know. So it's the same narrative, you know. Mm-hmm. But I really, if the young people could see the correlation between that music and what's going on today, then we probably could show them, say, look, you see, you know. So I really appreciate it because, you know, it is something I never knew before. But, you know, as I said, there is a direct correlation with what was played then and what is being played now. And the thing is, who is buying the music now? It's young white people, young white folks supporting it. It's not black folks, you know what I'm saying? So it's white people still continuing. You know, it's just sickening, I tell you.
Right.
Anyway, good brother, keep up the good work. And thank you so much, doctor, for this program.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Marcus. Thank you so much. Okay,
Bill,
you. When did we leave? I think we played Turkey in the Straw. And then did we do On the Level?
Right.
Did we do On the Level yet?
I think we can do On. How much time do we have? We can do On the Levee, or if we don't have enough time, we can skip that and go to the Christy Mentals.
We only have about 15 minutes. You know,
okay, let's go to Christy Mentals.
Hear you talk about this Virginia judge.
If we have to choose, yes, I hear where you're going. If we have to choose, we absolutely are going to go directly to Virginia Judge.
Okay.
Virginia Judge is a theatrical skit put into recording that really, it's done by Walter Kelly. I believe he is the the great uncle of the '50s movie star Grace Kelly. He's a vaudevillian and a comedian, but his recordings, and there's several of them, beginning in 1920, the Virginia Judge, really showcased the idea of a necessary reason why black men are criminal and must be, and he really kind of advances the idea of the need for mass incarceration in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. This Virginian judge looks at black men, or the people in his court are all black men who have done wrong things, and there's a attitude that is put into wax that is just absolutely extraordinary. There's a lot to say around this recording, so let's just go forward with that one. Okay. The Virginian Judge by Walter Kelly. This is the 1926 version. The 1921 is the one I would normally talk about, but let's listen to the 26 version.
Okay. I want to order in the court here.
Never had a razor, never had a gun. Never drank liquor, cause I can't get none. Tell me, Lord, how long?
Who's that, Dan? That nigga out on the lawn, I reckon, mowing off the grass. Tell him hush up, I'll put him back here in jail. First case on the docket, Caesar Galloway. Bring him out. Caesar, you all are charged by Officer Giddings with loitering around the post office building. What about it?
Hey, Judge, I come on down here from Fairfax County. I've been working in tobacco fields up yonder. And I got all through and I come down here. I come down here most every year. I sort of like a bluebird that comes and goes.
You look to me like a blackbird that comes and stays for the next 10 days anyhow. Lock him up there. Ashby Turner, bring him out. Ashby, you all are charged by Officer Lee with the attempted larceny of 2 chickens from the premises of Frank Lenz on Briarfield Road. What about it?
The judge, about 4 days ago, I reckon, I lost a very nice rooster. And I thought maybe he strayed over Mr. Lenz's yard because he'd been flirting around there lately.
You went out at 2 o'clock in the morning to look for him, did you?
Yes. Just when I got inside the coop, Mr. Lenz come out with a shotgun. He say, come out from there, I see y'all go in. And I got sort of scared and I stood still. He say, who in there? Speak before I shoot. I say, there's nobody here but us chickens. The judge, I hope the Lord will strike me down if I want to steal any Mr. Lenz's chickens.
You better stand aside about 5 minutes. If the Lord don't strike you, I'll give you 60 days. Put him back down. Willie Walden and Ashton Ray, bring those two out. What have you two been beating each other about? Go on, Ashton, tell us your side of it.
The judge, yesterday morning, on about 11 o'clock, I reckon, I went on down Lafayette Avenue to see Sells Brothers Circus Parade going by. And Willie stand alongside of me. And I said to him, look, yonder come a zebra. He said, boy, that ain't no zebra, that's a black mule with white stripes. And other boys stand alongside say, y'all is both wrong, he's a white horse with black stripes. Then everybody start arguing about it. And Willie said to me, boy, you certainly is ignorant. I say, you is more ignorant than I is. Then he starts shoving around. And I see what is going to mess me up, so I start on home. And just when I turned my back, he hung a feed bucket right on my head.
And what did you do?
Well, I just tagged him with a pair of ice tongs. That's all I done.
5 days apiece in the chain gang. Settle your arguments there. Next case on the docket, Travis Southall. Bring him out, Dan. I think I know him. Travis, you all are charged by Officer Gray with shooting dice and gambling at the premises of 110 Warwick Avenue. What about it?
Hey, Judge, I wasn't exactly shooting. I just sort of pushing them around. That's all I did.
I've had you here twice before on the same charge, boy. I'm going to give you 24 hours to get out of this town.
Hey, Judge, I'm going to give you 23 of them right back. I'll go in now.
You better go and keep on going, too. Bring out that bunch been mixed up in that shooting scrape, Dan. Hurry them along. What's your name?
My name's Kink Wallace, Judge.
What's yours?
Beauregard Z Long Street. What's the Z about? Well, just put that in through the separator, the two, Judge, that's all. What's your name?
My name's Pansy Marshall, Judge. I oughtn't have been brought here at all. That man Beauregard started every bit of fuss.
You three are charged by Officers Saunders and Gray with shooting firearms on the public highway and disorderly conduct. Tell us your side of it, Pansy.
Well, Judge, about 4 weeks ago, that man Beauregard come board at my house, and he lay around my house 4 weeks and don't pay me no board. And then he pretend he's sick. And I asked him what's wrong with him, and he say he don't know that he can eat, sleep, and drink all right, but he got no desire to work. I said, boy, you ain't sick, you're just gifted. But he keep on putting me off every day, and I just chuck him out my house, and I kept everything he got, too.
Did you keep his trunk?
No, Judge, that man had a trunk, he living in himself.
What did you keep on him?
Well, he didn't have much except a calendar and some fish hooks.
How did the shooting start?
Well, last evening I was sitting on my front doorstep with two of my other gentlemen boarders, Mr. Leroy, he worked at the garbage plant, and Mr. Jennings worked on the peanut dock. And Beauregard passed on by with Kink. And when he passed, he laughed at my other boarders, and he said to Kink, yonder two men slowly starving to death. I say yes, and I see some other man going to run himself to their prison. But he stand right in front of my house and make faces at me and talk scandal about me. And I always carry a little pistol with me so I can collect my board money. And when he won't go away, I just shot off the pistol, scare him away. I don't want to hit nobody.
Did you hear the shooting, King?
Yes, sir. That's what I did, Judge.
What did you do?
Well, just run, that's all I did.
Why did you run?
Just because I couldn't fly, that's all.
Where did you run to?
Well, I don't know exactly, Judge, but I know when I stopped, I had lather enough on me to shave Memphis.
Where were you, Beauregard? Well, I was slightly ahead of King. You two get out of here, and if I hear tell of you messing around her boarding house again, you'll go in the chain gang. Cost you $1, Pansy, for shooting firearms on the highway.
Hey, Judge, could I shoot at that man again for that same money?
You do any more shooting, you'll go to jail yourself. Get out here now. Get that dollar, Dan. Confiscate the weapon.
Mr. Brown?
What is it, Marcia?
Miss Austin says if y'all want to get your hair cut, you better come on. It's going to close up.
Dan, you better lock up those other prisoners. I've got to get my hair trimmed for us to close it up. I'll hear the cases tomorrow.
Cool.
A stunning recording on all possible levels. This is a conversation piece. This is like the coffee table book that everyone that everyone wants to talk about or look at. There is so much to say about this.
Yeah, it
recording.
Is a lot. That's a lot.
And about Walter Kelly. Perhaps I should allow questions to be asked. I have so much I could say on this.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, this
let
recording
me ask you something real
is
quickly.
As the centerpiece.
Let me ask you something real
of
quickly.
The idea about. Go ahead.
When I was listening to that, I thought about Pig McMarcum. Did a thing that he used to do called "Here Come the Judge." Had some similar things to that. Was that maybe some kind of an influence there? Do you know that for a fact, or is just...
Yes. Okay, thank you for segueing.
Okay.
A very important and controversial topic, which is that all of this material, these darky stories done by white vaudevillians on recording and often on stage, prior to these recordings in blackface, have provided the foundation, the very foundation for African-American comedy. We, as black people, somehow have adopted these icons. Pygmy Marco, Mantan Moreland in film in the 40s, also Eddie Rochester Anderson, but particularly Mantan Moreland. Of course, even more so, really critically, Step and Fetch It in the 1930s. All of this idea about comedy and about what we did wrong and breaking the law and being put in jail, even the famous, it's done by Jerome Kern, a Jewish man, very famous Jewish composer of the 19-teens and 20s, in Showboat, the iconic song Old Man River talks about being thrown in jail, get a little drunk, and I'm going in jail, Old Man River. Well, this whole idea about being in jail and being black and male and having, like inexorably having to be criminal and having to be put in jail, just sets in motion so much. I mean, before Michelle Alexander's The Nutrient Crow became the hot book and the important book that everyone was talking about, before Ava DuVernay's critical Netflix film called 13 looked at incarceration, mass incarceration, and the issue of the 13th Constitutional Amendment, all of this other material was already going on. So, yes, it's very significant, and, yes, it's related, and it, yes, it is. Not that Pygmy Martin immediately or directly or can, you know, there is, or there is in writing proof that he did that, but the tone, the mood, and the idea of the sketch has a direct connection.
Right. Now, I know that you are available to go and do these lectures throughout the country, so if there are anybody in our listening audience who might have access to a venue that could use that, why don't you give us your information? We've got about 3 minutes left, and I'll just give you that sure. time to talk about how someone can reach you and get access to this information in yourself.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Rogers, for having me on. It's been a joy and a delight, as well as an honor. I am Bill Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T. My website is BillDoggettProductions.com. You can, that's D-O-G-G-E-T-T, Productions with an S.com. You can contact me there, or I think probably use the contact page there, and that'll come directly to me. How you can have me come to your location? Obviously, I'm a speaker. There's a speaker fee. Speaker's fee is, of course, range depending upon what the budget is and what the circumstance is. Speaker's fee, obviously, there's a travel fee. Since I'm involved, I'm based in California, but I would be delighted to bring. What you just heard tonight is the audio. You haven't seen the visual part. The visual part is stunning that I have put together. And it is, there are actually several different versions, but the one that is specific that relates to this particular conversation we've had tonight is particularly provocative. So, yes, absolutely. Please feel free to contact me. You can also email me. My email address directly is B for boy, Doggett, my last name, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, 55@gmail.com. I'll repeat that, B, Doggett, D-O-G-G-E-T-T, the number 55, all of this runs together, there are no separations, @gmail.com. I would be delighted to hear from you. Thank you for your support, your interest, your comments, your questions. This is a big topic, an important topic. Looking at historical media, and one of the callers mentioned very importantly Spike Lee and Spike Lee's critical film, from my point of view, called Then Bamboozled.
Yes.
Spike Lee had a film. A historical media film person put together some of the most amazing clips of stereotypes from all across historical media, from early silent film to cartoons to musical theater, etc. All of this material is important to understand because it informs how we see ourselves today and how other people see us. It is at the foundation
right.
of what Charlottesville is all about.
Right.
Plus. So thank you.
Thank you so much. In the words of Langston Hughes, my soul has grown deep like the rivers from your presentation tonight. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
I look forward to speaking with you again. Have a wonderful night, audience. Thank you for listening.
Black as you.
Thank you.
Me.